Well, I see him as an anchor point for any period. He, of all the environmental thinkers I've read, put together perhaps the most cohesive view of the natural world. And he did it in a way that is more accessible and more persuasive than anyone else has done. So I see him as the essential man, the touchstone to whom we all go back, no matter our disagreements with him. And we should always be in tension with our mentors, in a sense. We should always be re-examining what has been passed down to us. But he is a giant, and no one has given us a more complete view or a better expressed view than Aldo Leopold.
Aldo Leopold was born in 1887 and died in 1948. From 1909 till 1924, he lived and worked in the forest regions of the American Southwest before moving to Wisconsin to teach at the university and to spend his free time at the shack, his home away from home. This is Jack Leffler. Over the next hour, we'll listen to many voices of those who have been influenced by Aldo Leopold, whose masterpiece, A Sand County Almanac, is regarded as one of America's finest contributions to world literature. Author Susan Flodder is a noted environmental historian who has looked deeply into the life and heritage of Aldo Leopold.
Aldo Leopold was born in 1887 in Burlington, Iowa. Grew up there in a house overlooking the Mississippi River. Leopold had decided that he wanted to go to the brand new Yale Forest School. Spent a year and a half at the Lawrenceville School in New Jersey, and then entered Yale University. So he graduated in 1909 with a Master of Forestry, and had only one goal in mind, which was to join the U.S. Forest Service. The service had been established in 1905, and his goal in life was to become a forest supervisor. He was assigned to the Southwestern District of the Forest Service, and went out to Albuquerque in July 1909 to begin his first job on the Apache National Forest in Arizona Territory. Statehood would be several years off. That was where he became attached incredibly to the landscape of the Southwest. 2 years later, he was called back to Albuquerque to be reassigned to a different forest. He met Estella Berger on that trip while he was in Albuquerque for a short time, and then was assigned to the Carson National Forest in northern New Mexico. After about a year, he became the acting and then finally the official forest supervisor. By the time he was 25 years old, he had achieved his life's ambition to be a forest supervisor. That was a forest that was a very multicultural forest. He was dealing with Jicarilla, Apache Indians, with Hispanos, with Pueblo people, the Taos, as well as with Anglos who were trying to wrest away the lands of the native peoples. And it was an extremely challenging assignment.
Enrique Lambadrid is a professor at the University of New Mexico and one of America's greatly respected folklorists.
Aldo Leopold's relationship to New Mexico goes way, way beyond the landscapes and into the human landscapes and history of this place. Aldo Leopold's wife was Estella Berger Luna. Estella Berger Luna was part of the Luna clan. She was a Nuevo Mexicana. She was what we call a Coyota, a person of mixed cultural heritage.
He married Estella in 1912, just as New Mexico had become a state. And they went to live on the Carson National Forest. And it was a wonderful place for them to spend the first months of their married life.
Estella Leopold is the youngest of the children of Aldo and Estelle Berger Leopold. She is a distinguished paleobotanist, now emeritus at the University of Washington, and a fine folk musician whose Leopold family repertoire includes many Hispanic folk songs of New Mexico.
But he was sick for 2 years flat after he had ridden across a pass and a snowstorm fell on him and his bedroll and everything was wet and he had to sleep in a wet bedroll for a couple of nights. By the time he made it to mother, to home, he had a bad kidney infection or condition and it knocked him out for a couple of years. It was terrible. By that point, I guess he went back down and took some administrative jobs in the Forest Service in Albuquerque. Leopold took a position with the Albuquerque Chamber of Commerce. He was actually the first paid executive secretary of the Albuquerque Chamber of Commerce. That lasted until after the war in 1919 when he applied to return to the Forest Service and was made assistant regional forester in charge of operations, roads, trails, personnel, fire control on 20 million acres of national forest in the Southwest. It was during that period that he conducted a lot of inspections of forests that he had known when he first came to the Southwest in 1910, and noticed the incredible differences, especially the erosion in mountain valleys, and became so interested in the forested watersheds of the Southwest and what could be done to maintain or restore their integrity. And I have always believed that it was out of that concern for the watersheds of the Southwest that he developed his land ethic philosophy.
Courtney White is the director of the Quivira Coalition and author of Revolution on the Range, The Rise of a New Ranch in the American West.
After he got sick and was reassigned to the regional office, they sent him on tours of national forests, really to study the resource, and particularly a couple forests in Arizona, the Prescott, where he saw a tremendous gullying. You know, I mean, a deep arroyos in these landscapes that he suspected were not natural, as he was taught or told that these were natural. And he began to make these connections between grass and soil and rain and slope and overgrazing, principally by cattle. He wasn't anti-grazing, but he certainly was anti-bad management. And then he went to the Blue River Range, and he saw the whole valley bottom washed out, and he began to write. In fact, he wrote a really amazing essay called Pioneers and Gullies, published in Sunset Magazine, of all places, you know, one of the popular magazines, 1924, where he decries the pioneer attitude towards land and how they just had come in, taken a European kind of way of living in a wetter environment with a certain kinds of agricultural practices, put it in an environment that he called a hair-trigger ecological environment, meaning the desert Southwest, and not understood the effects when those two things came together. Too many cows, you know, not managed. So then he started drawing lines between dots, between overgrazing, poor timber management, and then soil loss. And then he starts writing about when you lose soil, you begin to destabilize literally the foundation of civilization, because everything's, you know, once you lose soil, you're losing everything. And he writes constantly for the rest of his life about this experience.
As you are aware, Dad had been publishing essays that became eventually rewritten or edited chapters in this book of his, San County Almanac, for years. And he started out in the 20s writing conservation essays. But the chief elements of the book, which is an almanac, came from the Leopold Shack, where he was describing how it was in February and how it was in March and the birds. And he had these perfectly darling descriptions of the wildlife, along with the characteristics of the land, the restored land at our shack. And then he put at the end of this book, in the 40s, he was working on putting these together and had Charlie Schwartz do the artwork, which is his favorite artist from University of Missouri. Well, Jefferson City, Missouri. And
sent it to the Alfred Knopf, who turned it down. And then I don't know where else it went, but when it went to the Oxford Press, they accepted it, and that was in 1948 in the spring, and we heard that news. He got the news just before we went up to the shack, which was his last trip. So it was wonderful that he knew that his book was going to be published.
Early in his adulthood, Leopold read Tertium Organum by Russian philosopher P.D. Uspensky, wherein his sense of the spirit of a place, or even the whole planet, was reinforced.
There is another concept that he got from Uspensky, although he never credits Uspensky directly with it. It's the concept of the noumenon, as distinct from the phenomenon, phenomenon being the outward manifestation, what you can easily see and understand, and the noumenon being the inner meaning, the essence of something. One of the first times that he wrote about it was actually in another unpublished manuscript. He was writing a book on southwestern game fields. In one of the early chapters, he writes about deer as the noumenon of the southwestern mountains. He says, without the presence of deer, or the possibility of seeing a deer at each new dip and bend of the hillside, the southwest would be empty, a spiritual vacuum. The deer he saw as the noumenon of the southwestern mountains. Well, years later, he certainly would not have thought of deer as the noumenon of the mountains, especially when he spent so much time dealing with problems of overpopulation of deer and the damage that they were causing to other resources. In later years, obviously, it would have been the wolf that was the noumenon of the southwestern mountains. You know, it wasn't a new concept to him, I don't believe. I think it was a new philosophical term for something that he already intuitively felt, because he obviously thrilled to the howl of the wolf back when he was on the Apache and the Carson National Forest.
Nina Leopold Bradley is the elder daughter of Aldo and Estella Leopold. She is 91 years old and had just returned from cross-country skiing in time to be interviewed.
I could say that he is the most religious person I ever knew, and he never went inside of a church. He knew right from wrong. He lived his life ethically. He, didn't need the guidance of a deity. The years as we were growing up, I got to know him the best because we all worked together, we all played together. He was awesome in lots of ways. He was always teaching us, but never did you know he was teaching us. If you asked him a question, then he would just do everything to try to draw you out and make you think. But he never said, this is a so-and-so, and you should understand that it is related to the things next to it. He was very subtle in the way he taught.
Well, he was a gentle, wonderful father, kind of a little on the formal side in town. But when we were in the country, he was just loads of fun and full of jokes and very clever guy. Very good at field cooking, by the way. With his hands, he was a great craftsman. He made all the bows and arrows, which we all shot with. Mother became a winner. I think she won the state of Wisconsin first place archery placement for 5 years in a row or something. And she placed in the national. You know, she was amazing. So Dad made very good equipment, you see. Well, he was just a wonderful, warm person with, and actually kind of sentimental. Every once in a while that would show. And very good at helping us. When we were in the field on a walk or something, he would make leading questions like, how do you explain that track? What do you think that was? What happened here? And then, you know, who's been browsing this bush today? So what are the deer eating this week? You know, that kind of thing. Estella, look at that island over there. Why is it the trees on the upper end of the island are bigger than the ones on the bottom end? And I had to think about that one for a while. You know, finally figured it out. But anyway, that's the kind of guy he was. He was a Socratic teacher, really. Very good. Mom was wonderful. very supportive, of course. And they were very, very close. Dad came home every noon for lunch and walk in the door, and Mother would greet him with her apron on, and they would hug, and he would say, "Estella, the house looks so beautiful. How do you do it?" And sit down and have lunch and hold hands. You know, it was just great. They were very warm, and she was, of course, very supportive. Mother was a pianist, a musician at heart, but just sotto voce. She didn't make much of it. And was a very good disciplinarian, although she often, and Dad wasn't, he would hand it over to Mother. "You better take care of that, Estella," you know. She was an excellent cook, you know, and the house was very well organized. I just don't know how we could ever have become what we were, or Dad, without Mother. She was a lovely, charming, wonderfully eloquent lady.
He had a wonderful sense of humor. There was never any small talk around Dad. It was always very, very serious. But if something really captured him, he would just dissolve. I remember one time my sister was late in arriving at the shack. We were all there for the weekend. So she took the train and her bicycle and her pet squirrel, and took the train to Baraboo and then rode her bike into the edge of the marsh. And then she had to swim across the marsh. My father and I just happened to be out taking a walk, and Dad saw this creature coming along with a squirrel on her head. And I thought he was going to collapse in laughter. He just absolutely broke down. He had a wonderful sense of humor.
Well, you know, we were all going to the Leopold Shack, Dad's little country place, ever since I was 8 years old, and we used to go almost every weekend. And I said almost. It was literally every weekend Dad could afford to get away, like he didn't have a talk in Milwaukee or something. And so we spent a lot of time outdoors, and it was very easy for all of us children to get into some kind of natural sciences. Starker had gotten into wildlife, shooting right after Dad's footprints. Luna into hydrology and erosion problems. Nina in geography. Carl in botany. And then came me. And I became a botanist. Sort of, kind of a funny story. I was quite young, and Dad said something about, what do you think you want to do when you grow up? I said, "Well, I want to be a bugologist. I want to study bugs." And he said, "Why is that?" "Well," he said, "I said, everything else is taken." Yeah. Well, he said, "Let's go down to the bookstore on Monday and I'll get you a plant book and see what you can do with that," which is what he did, and it worked.
William DeBuys is himself a fine author and environmental activist whose thinking and writing have been greatly influenced by Aldo Leopold.
One of the things that I think he glimpsed that is now sort of a cornerstone of ecological thinking is the idea of energy flow through land, of water moving, of air moving, of nutrients moving, and so forth. And he had this vision, this integrated holistic vision of the flows through the ecosystem. And they took place often within the watershed unit. And so he saw the watershed as being a primary unit for land management, and even more for land understanding. It's interesting to me that he passed so much of this attentiveness along to Luna Leopold. Susan Flott told me that Leopold had written a long essay of some kind about the impact of grazing on arroyo cutting. And he was very concerned with the integrity of watersheds and saw the cutting of arroyos as being, in a sense, a mortal sin against the landscape because it does so much long-term damage, lowering the water table and increasing the pulse of erosion down into downstream watercourses and so forth. Well, Leopold saw that human uses of the land, trailing cattle, building wagon roads, grazing cattle, etc., contributed a lot to arroyo cutting, and so he wrote about this connection. And he sent this essay to a professor at Harvard, Kirk Bryan, who was a very important geologist at that time and had done a lot of work at Chaco Canyon and other places. And Brian was of a different school. Brian believed that arroyo cutting in the Southwest was subject to sort of geological cycles and that people might be able to speed up those cycles, but that the cycles were essentially weather or climate driven and geologically driven. So Brian disagreed with Leopold, evidently, enough so that Leopold never published this piece of work and never quite resolved this issue of human cause versus geologic and climate cause of arroyo cutting. But according to Susan, he encouraged his son, Luna Leopold, to go to Harvard and study with Kirk Bryan and see if he could get to the bottom of this. And Luna Leopold became one of the great hydrologists in the history of the science in North America, and did indeed spend a lot of time working on this, and finally came around to the compromise position, actually, between his father and between his professor, saying that he believed that, yes, arroyo cutting does follow geological and climatic cycles, but that human beings, with their activities, can take 50 years of natural arroyo cutting and compress it into 10, speed it up radically. And so one of the things I take away from this is the intellectual integrity of that whole Leopold family, that in a sense, pressing questions might be sent down over generations and people keep working on it. I think that's kind of fascinating. Not many families will do that. It's like a watershed unto its own, yeah.
In 1922, Aldo Leopold submitted a formal proposal that part of the Gila National Forest of southern New Mexico be administrated as a wilderness area off limits to vehicular traffic, mining, timbering, and heavy machinery. His proposal was accepted by the Forest Service in 1924, and thus the Gila Wilderness became the first such wilderness area in the United States. 40 years later, the Wilderness Act was passed into federal law. The passage of this act occurred on the watch of Stuart Udall during his tenure as Secretary of the Interior.
Clinton Anderson was an insurance man in Albuquerque, and he and Leopold became friends. I think this is probably in the early 1920s in Albuquerque. They used to discuss the national forests, and Leopold convinced Anderson that the wilderness bill was a good idea and there should be a law protecting wilderness. Anderson became a congressman, and he was a buddy, by the way, of Harry Truman, who used to play in the poker group. Anderson became a senator in 1948, and he became chairman of the committee in 1960, right after Kennedy was elected. He went to the White House, and he told Kennedy to sponsor a wilderness bill, and he handed him a copy of his bill, Senate Bill 5. He said, call for the enactment of a wilderness bill. Kennedy agreed and put it in his conservation message, and that led directly, and with Anderson having a lot of other sponsors, Lyndon Johnson signed it into law, I think in September 1964.
Again, Nina Leopold Bradley.
One of my father's students, Albert Hochbaum, was supposed to do the illustrations for a Sand County Almanac, and as Dad was accumulating the essays, he said to my father, now, Aldo, you weren't always right about everything. You had your ideas changed, and you have to admit that you used to kill predators. Well, he was kind of rough about it. Dad was a very sensitive person. So that, I think, is when Dad decided to write thinking like a mountain, that he did change his mind as he had more information. And he finally wrote Thinking Like a Mountain, sent it to Albert, and Albert was overjoyed.
Again, William DeBuys.
He wrote Thinking Like a Mountain in the spring of 1944. And so the best that his biographers have been able to figure is that the incident with the wolf, if it occurred, and you know, there's no hard documentation that it did, but probably it did occur, it probably occurred in 1909. That's what, 35 years earlier. And he speaks of this deeply moving epiphany he experienced of watching the green fire die in the wolf's eyes and realizing that he needed to think more like a mountain, that fewer wolves and more deer didn't necessarily mean a better world, that the wolf had a place in the world, that all the creatures in the world had a place in the life of the mountain, and that that was the mountain's point of view. This was a deep environmental conservationist epiphany, and yet, that was 1909. In 1920, he was still speaking to national conferences of game managers saying, we need to exterminate every single wolf and cougar remaining in New Mexico, and until we do that, the job of game management won't be done. So we have a conflict here. On the one hand, he speaks of an epiphany that he had in 1909 from the perspective of 1944. On the other hand, we have this hard evidence that in 1920, he wasn't exhibiting the wisdom of that epiphany. What conclusion can we draw? Well, to make a long story short, the fact is, as a great storyteller, Leopold had taken a lifetime of learning and compressed it into one small literary moment that makes a great story. But in fact, the real growth the man experienced was slow and incremental and continued over all those 35 years from 1909 to 1944 when he wrote the essay. And he, like all the rest of us, acquired what wisdom he acquired in bits and pieces, dribs and drabs over time. It didn't come in a single bolt of lightning. His life, for my money, gives us a better example of continuous learning, of being the perpetual student, of living alertly, of paying attention to the signals around you all the time, and acquiring wisdom incrementally, gradually, over the whole of one's life, not just having a single epiphany when you're 22 and then you know it.
Dave Foreman is regarded as one of America's foremost grassroots environmental activists.
It was a very volatile time for him developing his ideas and all. You know, he killed the green fire wolf in 1909, but it didn't have an immediate effect. 10 years later, he started what became the New Mexico Wildlife Federation, the New Mexico Game Protection Association, and they had a newsletter called the Pine Cone, and it was beating the drum for wiping out all wolves and mountain lions and other predators. And then the real turnaround came in the late 20s after the Park Service had killed off every wolf in the national parks in the lower 48 states, even in Yellowstone, taking out all the mountain lions. I mean, Yellowstone National Park was so hard, they were even had rangers out crushing pelican eggs because the pelicans were predating on the brown trout that was being put in for fishermen, and they were trapping out river otters because they ate the fish. They were just going after everything in the parks, getting rid of the bad animals for the good animals. And then they proposed to wipe out the wolves in Mount McKinley National Park in Alaska, which is now Denali, to increase the population of Dall sheep. Well, Olus and Abe Murray, who had done field research up there, got involved trying to stop that. the American Society of Mammalogists came on board, even the Ecological Society of America, and even the Boone and Crockett Club, you know, that Teddy Roosevelt started as a quality hunters group, all against the wiping out of predators in the national parks, particularly in Mount McKinley. And Leopold came on to that, too. But I think it was his relationship with the Muries and with other people there in the late 20s that really caused him to reflect back on his experience in the Southwest. It's really interesting to trace how he overcame these old prejudices, but it was the experience in the Southwest particularly that did that. And then as far as watershed goes, when he went down to Mexico and to the Sierra Madre in 36 and wrote later that it was the first time he had ever seen a healthy watershed because the Apaches had kept settlement out. So there had been no cows, there had been no predator control, there had been no fire control. And he said that in the Gavilan, for the first time, he saw a healthy stream and realized that everything he had seen in similar country in New Mexico and Arizona for the previous nearly 30 years had been unhealthy. And then he went to Germany to look at forest and saw how it was just, you know, plantation forestry. The foresters picked up all the branches that fell off and it was just clean. And those kind of experiences together at the sort of the same year, I think really got him thinking even more about his experience in the Southwest.
Again, Susan Flauder.
During that time, he was invited to give the John Wesley Powell address to the Southwestern Division of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and he took as his title The Conservation Ethic. That was the first published version of what would later, after several other principal addresses over the years, be combined in his seminal article, The Land Ethic, which is the capstone of a Sand County Almanac. And in reviewing those several essays, it has seemed to me that his concept of a land ethic grew very much out of his concern for southwestern watersheds and the problem of soil erosion.
Again, Courtney White.
And so that's how the whole idea of land health then comes to him. And it really comes to home to him in 1936 when he goes to the Gavilan in Mexico. And he sees a landscape that was largely untouched by people because it's still coming out of the Apache period. And so it's not been settled. So he goes on a hunting trip. And he sees what he calls a healthy landscape. And he didn't realize that up until that point, he'd be truly looking at unhealthy land. And so this really sets him thinking about land and land health and land use. And then the next step is how do you start to correct it, to prevent it? What incentives, what policies, what programs, what laws are needed to get folks, public or private landowners, to conserve these resources? Because what he saw was that once it starts to degrade, it's almost too late at that point. So this is why conservation is the motivating force for him. You want to conserve these resources before they start to degrade.
He thought hard, and he had an incredibly open mind. All his life, he was characterized by an open, questioning mind. He had three experiences that really were transformational for him. He acquired the shack, the land along the Wisconsin River that was exhausted, burned over, and abandoned by its previous owners. And Leopold and his family began working to restore that environment, to rebuild that community.
And again, Estella Leopold.
It's very open wasteland, really. The farmer had gone broke, putting in corn after corn, and left for taxes. And Dad got it for $8 an acre. So we got there, and Mother looked around and said, "Aldo, are you sure you want to bring the children up here?" And Dad said something like, "Yeah, you know, we're going to plant all this stuff. Put pinery up there on the ridge and put prairie out on the cornfield, and won't that be wonderful?" And it was. It was great. So we began work on the shack, and it became our home away from home, and it was no utilities, just a pump, and the Parthenon, the privy down the way on the edge of the terrace. And we were there every weekend, all the way through the 30s and the 40s, just about every weekend, and absolutely loved it. We built the fireplace, and we fixed the roof, and we put in windows and screens, and finally put in a floor, because we had a clay floor at first. Mother said we had to fix that, so we did. And we had bunks. We had a great time up there. And we were doing restoration ecology, which was the beginning of restoration ecology. Yeah, we put prairie plants into the cornfield, and after a while, there was enough weeds and these plants that we could burn it off. And Dad, we set fire to it, and right away, the grasses began to expand, because as the flames would come upwind, the grass would drop over behind the flames and drop the seeds on the fertilized ash and, you know, produce new plants. And pretty soon it became a tall grass prairie. It was wonderful. And then we began adding flowering plants to that prairie.
Actually, before he had much chance to do very much at the shack, he was invited on a trip to Germany, to the land of his ancestors, where he would study forestry and game management, as they had been practiced for centuries by the Germans. And when he got there, he was dismayed to find a completely artificialized environment. Deer that were being fed on crops that were grown outside of the forest because there weren't sufficient understory plants for the deer to forage on in the forest. The trees had to be bundled, protected with twigs and branches tied around their trunks because the deer would otherwise try to seek nutrients by stripping the bark from the trees. A very artificialized system. And Leopold came home. He wrote a number of articles on Germany, deer and Dauerwald in Germany. And when he got home, wrote an article on threatened species in which he made the case that we had to protect the diversity of wildlife that we still had in our country, but that Germany had lost. That was the first time that he actually made the pitch publicly for protecting wolves and grizzly bears and other species that he had once sought to exterminate from the Southwest. He also had a trip very shortly after that to Mexico, to the Sierra Madre, along the Rio Gavilan in northern Mexico, just south of the New Mexico-Arizona border. He was going to go deer hunting with bow and arrow, his new hobby. And he was so taken with that country along the Rio Gavilan, he realized that here there were still wolves and mountain lions, and they didn't seem to be interfering with the deer populations. There were still plenty of deer. Fires still passed regularly over the land, whether set by lightning or possibly by Indians. And fires didn't seem to hurt the environment. The streams were still running between mossy banks, their waters clear without a lot of gravel in the watercourse. This was a land that still had, its, as he put it, its perfect aboriginal health. That concept of land health was a new concept for Leopold, and it gave him a sense that the goals of what he had been doing all his life of land management actually now had the goal not simply to produce more deer or pines for harvest, but to produce a healthy ecosystem. And that juxtaposition of experiences at the shack in Germany and in Mexico along the Rio Gavilan was very transformational to him.
Gary Paul Nabhan is a well-known ethnobiologist and author who has long recognized the importance of understanding the relation of indigenous culture to respective habitat.
You know, I've been meditating on Aldo Leopold's second trip in the Rio Gavilan in the Chihuahuan borderlands that he took with his brother Carl and his son Starker and a number of friends from both New Mexico and Chihuahua. And it was ostensibly a hunting trip, but what he harvested there was far more than venison or quail or bear meat. What he found there was the concept of ecosystem health that we now use. He called it ecological health. And that concept included rather than excluded land-based cultures. And after living in New Mexico with the Luna family, after growing up in Iowa among many land-based ethnic cultures, he had this in his background that stewardship of the land, whether it's done by hunters and gatherers, or whether it's done by farmers and ranchers, can stabilize, enhance, or restore the diversity of depleted places and does not inextricably mean that humans will deplete that diversity. Where he discovered this was on the terraces of the Rio Gavilan in the headwaters of that watershed in 1937, where he realized that he was not in a fully natural, quote-unquote, landscape, but that prehistoric peoples had made rock terraces, what we call trincheras today, and that those had kept the watershed there intact to the point that centuries after those trincheras were constructed by people using dry-laid stone, deer were laying in the waist-high grasses on those terraces, eating the mast of acorns that had been maintained by the productivity, the soil renewal that happens when water cascades down through a terraced watershed. Now, the curious thing was that he talked about the Rio Gavilan as both a watershed and a food shed. And our notion of a food shed wasn't in common currency in 1937 when he was there. We're talking about something 80 years later that term has reached perhaps its greatest expression of what needs to be done to bring people back into the restoration of food-producing landscapes. Yet he talked about the food that he was eating in the Rio Gavilan as inextricably related to the health and wealth of that wild and cultural landscape. And I want to read you just a couple quotations that I think gets to this whole thing. He wrote, "Every region has a human food symbolic of its fatness," the land's fatness he's talking about. "The hills of the Gavilan find their gastronomic epitome in this wise. Kill a mast-fed buck not earlier than November, no later than January. Hang him in a live oak tree for 7 frosts and 7 suns. Then cut the half-frozen straps from their bed of tallow under the saddle and slice them transversely into steaks. Rub each steak with salt, pepper, and a little flour. Throw into a Dutch oven containing deep-smoking hot bear fat and standing on live oak coals. Fish out the steaks at the first sign of browning. Throw a little flour into the fat, then ice-cold water, then milk. Lay a steak on the summit of a steaming sourdough biscuit and drown both in gravy." Now, the structure here is symbolic, Leopold told us. The buck lies on his mountain, and the golden gravy is the sunshine that floods his days, even unto the end. Wow. This is a poem in the form of a recipe.
I think in a way, Aldo Leopold, he was just as human as anyone, and he was sort of culture-bound and had sort of ethnic tunnel vision. typical of his day. And we see this in one of his most famous essays, The Green Lagoons, which describes a canoe trip that he and his brother took in 1922 in the Colorado Delta, and they extol this wonderful landscape as a milk and honey wilderness. It's a place they don't find any sign of human beings except a very old axe cut and maybe a tin can or something that's old and rusted. So he talks about this as the true wilderness, and it has no people. But the fact is that the Kokopa Indians, who had been there for centuries, and others before them since time immemorial, were only recently departed because of settlement activities upstream that had diverted too much of the Colorado River water away from the flats of the delta, where the Kokopo relied upon the annual natural growth of a millet-like grass whose seed they subsisted on in part. And so Aldo Leopold was going into this much altered ecosystem thinking it was pure wilderness nature, but in fact it was an altered place where the native inhabitants had had to leave because of the alteration. Okay, honest mistake. But why is this important? Well, it's important for two reasons. One is that there's a tradition in American wilderness thinking that somehow the purest land is the land without people in it. But there were people in all the lands. Our wilderness movement really didn't get started until the native people were removed from most of these wilderness areas, and so they became safe for people to go and camp and recreate in and so forth. But the fact is that all these places were occupied. And the second reason is that if we ignore the presence of those people in our thinking about wild lands, we also ignore the wisdom that they can provide us, the wisdom that inheres in their life ways and in their traditions that can give us insight into how we should comport ourselves and what we should do in our relationship with the land.
Esteban Arellano is a Nuevo Mexicano who has a long history as a Chicano activist. He has also conducted a great deal of critical research into the life ways of peoples whose cultures are indigenous to the Southwest.
Well, that's something that I think a lot of the environmentalists have missed, you know. As humans, at least, I can't separate myself from nature, you know. I'm no different than a coyote who's walking along the banks of the Acequia. When I go there in the Acequia, I see the tracks of the coyote, I see the tracks of the mountain lion, and sometimes my skin just kind of shrivels up, you know, and because I'm also aware of what they can do to me, especially a mountain lion, you know. And then I just like to go out with my dogs and follow the tracks of the coyotes. And one day I was noticing that my dogs were following a coyote. And the coyotes don't run straight. They go like that, zigzag, 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 until they tire the dogs instead of running straight. What I found out is that the landscape has a memory, only that we have forgotten what that memory is. So we have to go back and rediscover that memory. And that's one of the things that I've been doing. Like here in my place, I discovered that there were terraces here that apparently my grandfather had done. But when I moved here, because my grandfather died in 1935, so I never knew none of my grandfathers because, like I said, I was the youngest of my family, you know. But probably because of being the youngest, you know, I always would think to myself, I wonder what my grandfathers were like. You know, I would have really liked to have been able to sit down like we're sitting down here and talk with them about the land, you know.
Milford Muscat is a Navajo born on the Navajo Nation in Tohatchi, New Mexico. He holds a PhD and is a professor of environmental studies at Shoreline College in Seattle, Washington. Here, he describes his attempt to meld Western science with Navajo cultural perspective.
One of the biggest things that I've come to realize is that life is a ceremony. Everything you do, every action, every thought, every movement, every step is ceremony in some context. You're always having to give reverence to who you are and the places around you. So walking in beauty, Huanzhong, is all that. It's basically the idea that Life is a ceremony. Keep everything sacred. In all your actions, you need to keep that relationship. I justified making Huizhou more a environmental community-based identity and assumptions, in that in order for us to understand our relationship to nature, we need to understand ourselves as part of a community, part of a larger community other than just humans, plants, animals, clouds, spirits, entities that are all part of this cosmology. And so Huizhou in itself takes this idea of community. And you cannot specifically say Huizhou is this walking beauty relationship to each other humans. It's our walking beauty within the context of nature, within the context of the spiritual community, in the context of what people call the inanimate aspects of nature. You know, the rocks, the clouds, the sagebrush. All of these are part of this idea of this relationship for walking beauty. I don't see any other way how to define this concept.
Rena Swensel was born into the Santa Clara Pueblo along the Rio Grande in northern New Mexico.
What I've been thinking about a lot with community is that we've gotten too small a definition of community. And I go back to Pueblo thinking because there, community really was not just the human community. It included the place within which we lived, so that the mountains were part of community. The water was part of community. Trees, rocks, plants. You couldn't move through any day in that old world, even when I was growing up, without knowing that you were part of that whole community of trees, rocks, people. Today, what we do is really just talk about human community, and it gets to be such a small thing within the larger scope of things. We keep making the world smaller and smaller until it's nothing but us. It's just human beings, out of context, out of our natural context, out of our cosmological context. We have become so small in our view of the world. Our world is simply us human beings. That's a crucial thing that we need to get beyond and move back again to seeing ourselves within context.
I think what Leopold was trying to tell us was that a civilization that disconnects itself from the land ultimately pays the price. And he looked historically at civilizations that, you know, that kind of separated themselves. And I think in many ways, America and other industrialized nations are experimenting with a massive and highly risky enterprise. Can we disconnect ourselves from land, from soil and water and grass, and survive? And I think that question is not clear yet, but I think certain signals we're getting that probably is not a good thing to have done, to kind of pull it away from a bond, a relationship with nature. We get our food from far away. We don't spend much time in nature. If we do, it's quick, recreational in nature. And we're hoping that through technology or through something that we can kind of keep all of this going, where Leopold was constantly reminding folks that when societies do that, they tend to break down at some point. That when we lose that bond, when we lose the land that has nurtured us and supported us, that's not sustainable. And that was his kind of overriding message through the 30s and 40s. It fell largely on deaf ears as industrialism took off and as the goodies that industrialism brought us, you know, cheap food and lots of stuff, kind of came cascading down on us. We said, well, yeah, maybe we can do this. Maybe we can create a food system that just pushes all our food away, the production away. We can play on the land. I'm not so sure that he was wrong. Maybe we need to think about this bond with land. And we're finding out, I think, now that there are big consequences for having tried this experiment. And I'm desperately hopeful that we can find a way to kind of reconnecting, rebonding ourselves to dirt, to soil, to water, be it through work, through food, through play, through whatever it is that we need to do to get back in touch with the kinds of things that the Native Americans have talked about and other folks in land-based communities have talked about for a long time that we've just kind of taken for granted. And we better not take it for granted for much longer at our own peril.
He was counting geese for his daughter Nina and her husband Bill Elder to see whether geese flew in family flocks, what the size of the flocks was as they came in the evening or flew out in the morning. And he counted more geese in his last counts at the shack that weekend in spring on the 20th or 21st of April, 1948, than he had ever before counted at the shack. And then while he was busy sharpening tools and getting ready to work during the morning, he saw smoke rising across the marsh on his neighbor's property and realized that it was getting worse and that the fire must be getting away from them, that he and Estella and Big Estella, his wife, should go and help to put out that fire. He stationed them along the road. He went walking with a fire pump toward the flames, and that was the last that the family saw of him. He probably had a heart attack and lay down in the grass. Fire passed gently over him, and that was it.
The final essay in Aldo Leopold's A Sand County Almanac is entitled The Land Ethic. To me, this is one of the most important pieces of writing in the English language, and I'd like to share a passage with you. But first, I want to say that for generations, America and Western culture have been dominated by an economic paradigm founded largely on turning habitat into money. Aldo Leopold came to understand the folly and error of that thinking over 60 years ago. He also learned early on that we as a species are but a single part of the community of life on our planet, and that indeed we are rooted in nature. At this point in history, it is imperative that we heed his words in this final essay, and I quote, "A land ethic, then, reflects the existence of an ecological conscience, and this in turn reflects a conviction of individual responsibility for the health of the land. Health is the capacity of the land for self-renewal. Conservation is our effort to understand and preserve this capacity." Production of Aldo Leopold in the Southwest was made possible by grants from the Aldo Leopold Foundation in Baraboo, Wisconsin, the Christensen Fund in Palo Alto, California, and the New Mexico Humanities Council. Our program is a production of The Lore of the Land and was produced in association with KUNM, Community Public Radio in Albuquerque, New Mexico. For The Lore of the Land, this is Jack Loeffler. Thank you for listening.